The first of these points is the power to regulate the thoughts and master attention, and then to concentrate fully in any required direction. The mind possesses a natural tendency to run in various directions and to flit from one subject to another, on account of the pressure of emotional attachments, physical environment or imperfect education. This tendency can be stopped and corrected by the psychological discipline of meditation. The power to become completely absorbed in the subject in hand can then be unfolded. The meaning of such concentration is extreme attentiveness to the topic under consideration, never permitting it to lapse through laziness or fatigue. The mind must move only when the will directs it. Much may be accomplished through this single power of concentration. It is a steady force which, when directed towards any purpose or obstacle, overcomes such resistance. The acetylene welding ray, which melts the hardest steel, is a fit example of physical concentration. Similarly, the faculty of fixing attention at will and retaining it ultimately helps to burn away through the hardest intellectual problems. The second factor of philosophic importance to be sought after in the mystic discipline is equipoise, a calm, steady and even disposition of mind which will withstand shocks. When passions rage strongly within a man, when anger flares up too frequently or when desires threaten to submerge him, he becomes unbalanced. And when powerful emotional complexes are opposed by adequate reasons, when domestic troubles or business anxieties unremittingly distract his attention, or when the temperament is unstable and vacillating, flitting from one thing to another, mental conflicts must inevitably arise and harass a man. In all these conditions, steadying of the mind may be effected by meditation practice. Through its aid, a better equilibrium between feelings and thoughts, between thoughts and thoughts, between passion and reason, may be tentatively evolved and fitfully maintained. Permanent equilibrium, however, can be established only by completing a course in philosophic discipline. Nevertheless, meditation in the hands of a moderately advanced practitioner can quickly remove violence and agitation of the mind, as well as pacify its conflicts. Excited feelings can be subdued, the strength of wrath reduced, and hot desires that distort life put aside by resort to the discipline of meditation. This settles the mind down again and restores its evenness and balance, at any rate for the time being. The Indian yogis call such a condition of resistance to momentary passions and of general loose self-control level-headedness. We may prefer to call it inner peace. The third point to be noted is the unfoldment of reverie. This is of profound importance and the highest value when, in the more advanced stages, the student attempts to gain the final fruits of his philosophic effort, the realization of ultimate truth. It is that which appears in the constant endeavor of the mystic to cease external activity, to shut out the distractions of his material environment, to stop the operation of his five senses, and to develop a condition of complete introversion. The latter is akin to the profound abstractiveness and creative moods noted in the lives of famous geniuses. This sustained inwardness may consummate itself even in trance. But the essential factor is the capacity to reorientate the attention at will from the world of concrete things to the world of abstract thoughts. Many a practical man of business or industrial affairs possesses a keen, sharp mind but is yet unable to move amid abstract ideas because he can apply his attention only to concrete objects. This capacity for subtle introspection is an unusual one. It is now convenient to explain a matter in connection with mysticism and percent yoga which was out of place in the earlier treatment devoted to it, and which will throw some light upon the formula problem raised in the first chapter. Every philosopher must possess these three qualities of concentrativeness, calmness, and reverie. In these respects he will be a mystic, but most mystics are not philosophers. Mysticism may now be viewed as a disciplinary stage through which the would-be philosopher must pass if he finds, as most do, that he lacks such qualifications. The difficulty of completely concentrating the thoughts in ordinary life, which is so familiar and so personal, is well known. How much greater must it be in philosophic research, which is so remote and impersonal? The difficulty of such research soon tires the unwilling mind unless it has previously developed the strength which comes through such discipline. and without the complete concentration which mobilizes the mind to a single pointed end, and which keeps out extraneous thoughts, resistance will beset the effort to grasp either the meanings of philosophic problems or to move onward to their proper solutions. The lengthy trains of thought in which the philosophical student is forced to indulge absolutely demand the presence of this quality. His mind must be competent to take them up without being shaken from its purpose by extraneous ideas or disturbing environments. Furthermore, the composure of mental peace is an essential prelude to the undisturbed investigation of truth. The man who cannot keep conflicts and anxieties out of his mind will not be able to keep his attention uninterruptedly fixed on philosophic matters. The poise needed for such reflection can be got from meditation and will help to prevent emotional interferences, remove ideological obstructions and permit the student to approach his study with a clearer mind. It is a commonplace fact that excitement darkens intelligence, that sound well-balanced judgment cannot be delivered when the mind is full of wrath, but both are dismissed or disappear under the calming influence of yoga. Even if a man possess sharp understanding, he may injure its philosophic value if he uses it when he is angry. The mind must be emotionally free for study. When hostility to another man or an injury done to oneself rankles within it, or when it is excessively discontented, it becomes distracted and to that extent unfit for profound reflection. It will later become necessary in the course of this quest to defeat the naive reports of the bodily senses and penetrate to a region they know not of. This task is difficult because the average man more or less believes his mind is imprisoned in the body and unconsciously handicaps himself by this belief, which will be proved erroneous. If this task is to be achieved, it can be done only by first detaching the mind from its self-imprisonment and thus rendering it flexible enough to find that region. The habits of introspection and abstraction engendered by meditation prove indispensable pre-essentials here, and in the investigation of the significance of sleep, the value of such extreme fineness or subtlety of mind will also be realized. Moreover, all metaphysical thinking is made much easier by an earlier experience of meditation. And when the mind must move quickly from the practical world into the consideration of ultimate principles and abstract themes, the intensely sharp attentiveness of the yogi can enable him to grasp them more effortlessly. From these observations, it will be seen that philosophy regards the yoga of concentration as an invaluable psychological training which it prescribes to qualify a man for its pursuit. Such yoga assists the understanding of the world to the extent that it helps to shape the instrument of mind with which we must get such understanding. The mystic who unfolds reverie and calmness through meditation and stops there, intent upon enjoying the peace or ecstasy he may feel, will remain in ignorance of the supreme truth about life, although he will have gone farther than others in self-knowledge. He may feel happy, but he will not be wise. To put the matter in a nutshell, the yoga of philosophical discernment is the necessary sequel to the yoga of mental concentration. The one is lu required to prepare the mental instrument which must be used in the operation of the other. It must also be repeated that only when meditation is correctly practiced is it likely to be useful for this quest or indeed any other. When wrongly done or when carried to excess, it becomes a hindrance to philosophic activity, breeding fresh evils, whims and fancies which will need to be overcome and which were not formerly present. It should be practiced within suitable limits. When people lose sight of these disciplinary and purificatory purposes of mysticism and magnify it to the exclusion of all else, they not only fail to remove their complexes but may even increase them. It will be noticed that the philosophical aim is definitely different from that of mysticism. In the latter, the neophyte rises in the scale by repressing thought, here he rises by exerting thought. The one teaches inertia, the emptying of mind, whilst the other teaches activity, the expansion of mind. Both are correct in their own places, and do not conflict. The mystic stills the mind in order to get thought control, but once the control is attained, he should begin to think vigorously. Thus he should kill thoughts only to use them better later. Meditation practice must in this more advanced stage be set behind the study of philosophy. The correct order now is to begin with the one and finish with the other. But the seeker who is satisfied with nothing short of ultimate realization may not stop even here. For when his philosophical course is run, he will once again drop the labors of thinking and his mystical practice. This time, however, thinking will now come to its deserved rest spontaneously, of its own accord, its purpose fulfilled, whilst his absorption in yoga will now be a natural day-long process, secret, unmanifest, and not interfering with his practical everyday activities. It is not possible to achieve this final stage of ultimate realization unless he has perfected himself not only in both formal yoga and formal philosophy, but also in the art of immediately expressing their logical consequences in vigorous action. In earlier books, it may be remembered, the writer made a most elementary fragment of the higher analytic philosophy the basis of certain meditation exercises, thus attempting what was rarely done among mystics, to render even the meditation exercises fruitful, for later philosophic purposes. This was an original contribution introduced because he did not want his readers to become fools, which so many mystics appear ardently to desire, and also to prepare the way for the work of the present volume. Indeed, it was written in the quest of the over-self, this is the true fulfillment of yoga, to wield thought as a master and then discard it. Such a statement was quite correct and perfectly justifiable when considered in relation to the level of those for whom it was written, that is for those striving to succeed in the yoga of mental concentration. The highest ideal of this level is to still the mind, reduce thoughts and bask in the sunshine of mental peace. But now the student who has made some progress in meditation and seeks to rise to a higher level ought to reverse the statement quoted. There will be no contradiction here, only a continuation and further fulfillment of the quest into higher strata. In his exercises he should practice stilling the mind first and immediately after that awaken it into fullest vigor for the pursuit of philosophical inquiry. Whereas before he suppressed thought, now he should seek to examine and direct it. Henceforth he will be alert to nature and note her workings where before he dismissed her and cared only to turn inwards. He may keep his inner peace and stillness, philosophy will not rob him of that. But he should not imagine it to be the ultimate goal. It is a stage closer to the apprehension of reality, but it is not reality itself. If he works in the way recommended here, he will approach still closer to the final apprehension of ultimate reality. Only near the end of this quest can formal yoga and philosophy again become co-equals, for then both will have to be fused and then transcended. Reason must master emotion. The sixth of this group of psychological attributes which marks the competent student is not likely to be palatable to most people. At every stage of philosophical research, the student must suppress his emotions and sentiments whenever they come into sharp conflict with reason. Whenever the psychological process has been illuminated, it has been found that, especially in the examination of complex problems, as well as in the evaluation of rival ideas, the tendency of undisciplined persons to cloud clear thinking by a confused emotional haze is inveterate. They usually see the world and interpret the experiences of life through this haze. It is the business of the student to clear it away. The human personality holds within itself congeries of conflicting desires and contradictory impulses. It provides refuge for instinctive passions and ancient urges whose deep-seated character is not always suspected until critical moments bring them fully to the surface. All these forces are so powerful that it is true to say that most men live more by feeling than by thinking. The consequence is that they color most of their thinking with conscious or sublime the hidden teaching beyond yoga conscious wishes and desires, with irrational neurotic fears and other emotional complexes. They have not seldom been known to put chains on their feet in the form of disreputable personal cravings which are essentially harmful to their own interests. The ebb and flow of these feelings and impulses drives them involuntarily and renders it difficult for them to base their general attitude towards life on solid facts or right reasoning. We may see the meaning of these statements more clearly by watching unchecked emotion at work in larger fields than that of the individual. During the tense days of war, passion sweeps through people and often reaches crescendo point. A nation may then be led like a sheep to slaughter into decisions fatal to its true interest. During political elections, whole crowds fall into emotional excitement and are then easily swayed by demagogues. At such times it is obvious that their minds are obfuscated and rigorous reasoning is out of the question. And doctors attached to asylums know that when the emotional excitement of mobs becomes so intense as to be uncontrollable, it is recognizably similar to one of the symptoms of insanity with which they are quite familiar. Strong gusts of emotionalism therefore provide a barricade against which the attacks of reason are futile. Emotion unchecked by reason is one of the great betrayers of mankind. Two powerful emotions, hate and greed, are together responsible for many of the crimes in world history. The passions engendered by sex are responsible for terrible troubles. Herein lies one of the causes of the traditional privations and vetoes which society has imposed on the free and full manifestation of emotion in decent social intercourse. Now the philosophical student especially cannot afford such emotional luxuries. He knows that when feeling inundates the whole life of a man, it does so to the detriment of his intellectual nature. And because his chief instrument of penetration into the domain of truth is nothing but the mind itself, sharpened to a delicate edge, he must sooner or later come to a definite choice between the constant exercise of reason and restraint or the constant indulgence of emotion and passion. He more than others must beware of delusions bred by personal sentiment, of letting sober judgment give way to infectious enthusiasm, of sacrificing cold fact to heated imagination, and of swinging through the alluring arc of delusions bred by personal sentiment or sexual desire. He cannot possibly discover truth if he is not willing to depart from an unreliable standpoint at its behest. It is not the pleasure or the pain which any idea or event yields him which is entitled to determine either its truth or its value, for these emotions merely reveal something about his own character, but nothing about the true nature of the idea or event itself. Feelings easily entangle the thinking faculty and prevent its clear operation. The irrational element in the human soul is forever seeking the feeling of satisfaction and forever avoiding that of frustration, merely because the one produces pleasure and the other pain. Primitive people who have not evolved their reasoning powers provide a clearer illustration of this principle than civilized men. And who does not know that the verdicts of anger are mostly ephemeral, whereas those of reason always endure? The questions which come for consideration in philosophy are often so finely balanced that emotion may quite easily obtrude its arbitrary judgment against the cooler voice of reason and thus prevent the student from perceiving the real truth. And his difficulties are enhanced because human feelings know how to camouflage themselves cleverly. Human desires in particular are extremely competent to seduce reason. Few people recognize the real motives for some of their most important actions. There are many internal barriers to such recognition that are of their own building or that are purely inborn. They have wrapped the bandage of many an emotional complex around themselves which must be painfully unwound again before truth can be seen. They twist knowledge not seldom to suit their complexes. A student may in a hypothetical case even have a sharply developed mind, and yet his attachment through desire may make him favor his belief in the ultimate materiality of the physical world when all proof might point to its ultimate nature being essentially mind stuff. He may also not like this and that person, yet, for the purpose of understanding them, he ought to be prepared to refrain from allowing such a sentiment to sway his examination. Otherwise he will blunt his power of judgment and blind his faculty of insight. The learner's liking or disliking of certain facts or certain experiences has nothing to do with their truth or with their reality. If he insists on making such attractions or repulsions his guide, as do most people, then he will never succeed in finding either truth or reality. The surface of a lake can reflect an image without distortion only when it is free from disturbance by the wind. Allied, the mind can properly inquire into truth only when it is free from disturbance by strong feelings. Wishful thinking is always pleasant but often unprofitable. The hope of philosophy lies in following reason, and not in thwarting it by following inordinate desires and emotional vagaries. Even unbalanced ambition and undue vanity will distort thinking and prevent the acquisition of accurate knowledge. Anger and hatred, however, are notorious misguiders. When unrestrained, all these emotions are lying invaders who nevertheless claim to speak truth. Hence those who persist in denying reason in the interests of their feelings thereby render themselves unsuited to this quest, just as those who prefer to keep their mentalities warped, their passions untamed and their instinctive repulsions uncontrolled can never attain a true understanding of the significance of life. For they will engage themselves in the futile and even impossible endeavor of fitting truth to a Procrustean bed of involuntary and internal compulsions. A scientific fidelity to fact irrespective of personal feeling will alone carry the student to a successful issue of his researches. When the reasoning faculty is loaded with thick sentiments and narrow preferences, it is soon unconsciously perverted. Every emotion becomes potentially dangerous when it takes upon itself the task of guiding reason instead of letting reason guide it. To think truthfully, therefore, the neophyte must courageously enforce a strict self-discipline. This is the awful sacrifice which he is called to commit, this holy offering of what he desires upon the lofty altar of what is. A manifestation of feeling which is peculiarly prone to bring the unwary student into danger is undue, unjustified enthusiasm. It is a star which often blazes brightly for a time, only to sink down on the horizon of disappointment. Quite notoriously, enthusiasts sail freely over established facts into an empyrean of mere theory. Not seldom they lack discrimination and certainly detachment. Therefore their judgments are often distorted. The seeker must take care, therefore, not to be carried away by any kind of enthusiasm when considering evidence or forming judgment. He should always be on his guard when in the literary or personal presence of the overheated doctrinaire, as well as of the hard bigot who has closed his mind. He should refuse to pronounce upon any subject which he has not investigated upon sounder evidence than the misrepresentations of his personal preferences. If he shirks this caution, he is likely to open the gate for fantasies to come into his being or for specious and delusive reasoning to mislead him. The novice in philosophy must seriously set out to train himself to disregard both emotional aversions and emotional attractions during the hours of his study. He has to free his mind from its inherited inborn and acquired distortions. He must not let impossible fancies and wildly visionary excitements sweep him off his feet. All such imaginations must be brought analytically into the foreground of the mind and there submitted to the closest impartial scrutiny. If he resists this process and fails to insulate himself against them, as he is likely to do in the earlier stages, he merely delays the time when his feet can be led to truth. Thus we arrive at the hoary wisdom that if in the kingdom of men emotion rules for the moment, reason should rule in the end. These have been hard sayings. They are likely to be much misunderstood. Hence a warning must be uttered for the second time within this chapter that the student is not asked to kill intimate emotion and destroy warm feeling, that indeed is quite impossible. He is asked only to keep them subordinate to reason and not let them when contrary to it rise to the top of his being. He may rightly and usefully appeal to emotion when it is supported by reason. Not the destructions of sentiment and feeling should be his aim, but their proper guidance and control. Emotion is a part of man's nature and is therefore incapable of elimination. It must be given its fit place in his life. But reason must direct its course whenever the two come into collision. Nothing worth keeping is to be stifled, but everything is to be brought into right relation. Nor is the worth of properly directed reasonable enthusiasm to be undervalued. It gives precious driving force to the novice and insulates him against biased critics and baseless opposition. Indeed, all feeling is the propulsive element in human personality and leads more to action than anything else. Hence the melancholy spectacle of unfeeling philosophical bookworms who are unable to live up to their noble reasonings. However, the aspirant will certainly have to curb the disabling passions of anger and obliterate the abysmal sin of hatred, because only such a self-critical habit fits him to find truth. He must make this resolve plain in every conflict. He must demand complete candor from himself. Not wanting to face a problem must not be the excuse for shirking it. He may not and will not always be able to control the rising surge of feelings or to check the irrational compulsions from within, but at such times he ought at least to seek to understand them and weigh them for what they are. Thus even when he surrenders himself to them he will no longer do so blindly. It is a considerable gain for the earnest novice to arrive at such a step. His desires will surely diminish under the probe of keen analysis and thus render his mind more peaceful. And out of such governance of feelings there will inevitably follow a more organized and disciplined governance of conduct. He will begin to live as a better and wiser man. It should not be surprising after such reflections to learn that philosophy is more the business of the masculine sex than its counterpart, and more of maturity rather than of adolescence. It is generally easier for men to follow this path than for women, although nature compensates by rendering the mystic path easier for women. Women act naturally more prone than men to permit reason to stoop to the baits of sentimental emotion and to permit them to cloud the sky of thought. Due to social causes, Western women are more intellectual than their Eastern sisters, but they cling more strongly to egoism. Hence either matter of this truth quest they are no better off. However, it will always remain axiomatic that an exceptional woman will forge her way out of these weaknesses, face the unconscious motives which beset her, and claim her higher heritage from nature. Finally, we find that philosophy is better suited to those who are nearing middle age than to the youthful. The young are more quickly moved by emotion and passion than their elders, who, possessing riper experience in the unwritten discipline of life, are more level-headed. But here again the beautiful law of compensation is also at work. For it is the privilege of youth to tread new paths of thought with a magnificent daring that others lack. Give up the ego. From all these struggles there will slowly appear of itself the seventh and final characteristic, but the aspirant must now take up its cultivation in full awareness of what he is doing and after full deliberation. This is the willingness to look directly at life through a clear lens and not through one tinted by the predilections and preconceptions of his ego. It is perhaps the most difficult of all his preparatory tasks consciously to unfold this impersonality. However, its importance can hardly be overrated. Every man who has not undergone the philosophic discipline is inclined to rate his own judgments far more highly than they merit. He usually seeks to arrive at conclusions which gratify his implanted prejudices and satisfy his inherited bias. It is quite customary for him to accept no facts in an argument save those that dovetail into his existing outlook. In this way and not infrequently he comes to reject what he urgently needs, as an invalid may refuse to swallow a bitter-tasting medicine which he needs far more than the sweet confection for which he asks. Every time a man thrusts his ego into a train of thought its balance is disturbed and its truth value distorted. If he is to judge every fact by the standards of his earlier experience alone he will thereby prevent new knowledge from arising. When we examine the manifestations of his mentality in speech and act his general if unconscious attitude appears to be, this fits in with what I believe, therefore it must be true. This agrees with my views, therefore it must be true, this fact does not conflict with the facts of which I am aware, therefore I shall accept it, that belief is quite contrary to what I believe, therefore it must be wrong, that fact does not interest me, therefore it has no value in discussion, that explanation is hard for me to understand, therefore I dismiss it in favor of one which I can understand and which must consequently be true. Whoever wishes to be initiated into genuine philosophy must begin by casting aside such merely egoistic standpoints. They show forth his conceit and vanity, his quest of corroboration of his own preconceptions and prejudices, and not the quest of truth, his study of the printed page only to confirm his foregone conclusions, his resort to a teacher not to gain new knowledge but for endorsement of his old beliefs. By keeping the eye foremost in his thinking he is unconsciously drawn into various and vicious fallacies. The sympathies and antipathies generated by such personal views constitute hindrances to the discovery of what an idea or object really is in itself. They often cause a man to see things which do not exist at all, but which through association of ideas he imagines to exist. It is a pathological fact that the various forms of insanity and mental disorder are rooted in the ego, and all the obsessions and complexes are likewise connected with the I. He who has not undergone the philosophic discipline is frequently infatuated with himself, and his state of mind is bounded on all sides by the pronoun I. This I cheats him out of truth, for it blocks his path to correct perception.